This is Think or Be Eaten, going to do a series with Larry the Contractor Guy, who has spent quite some time just researching the whole Nazi movement. And it is interesting, not for prurient reasons, but as I've often wondered now, too, since I've read the Lusitania, the people in Germany prior to World War I, it seems, were not the same folks. And I don't mean just age-wise. I mean, they were not the same mentality that those of those who were in the Weimar Republic. It's, to me, and I know to Larry, and we talked about this a lot on the side, what in the world ever got into those folks? And I'm doing ominous parallels, which I think might give a little underpinning to where the German mentality was at during the Weimar Republic days. But we're going to find more about that from Larry. And we're going to go through however long it takes. And that we have ominous parallels on the side, that's great, because that tries to explain it in another reason, but not to the depth that Larry has. And we're also going beyond into all the personages that were involved in the Reich. So, Larry, we've talked a lot about this, but we've never really done anything. I know you've done it, I think, with Gordon and such. I'm not sure. But let me ask you first of all, thanks for availing yourself of being on and for the time you're going to do it.
Yeah, glad to be here, man.
Let me ask you firstly, it isn't something strange that one would want to kind of like go into the nuts and bolts about whatever the heck happened over there. I don't think anybody really, a singular person, has ever marshaled enough resources and tried to posit how that all happened. But as far as you go, that is something that, in a historical sense, you were very interested in. Is there something, can you tell us, was there one thing, two things, what hit you about what that was all about that you wanted to probe as deeply as you can? And like Nietzsche said, man, you look long into the abyss looks long into you.
Yeah. I think one of the things that happened in my life that put me on this path was my relationship with my uncle. I had an uncle by marriage. He was married to my father's older sister. His name was Vernon Blackwell. My Uncle Vernon was a really dynamic guy. He had been a star football player in high school and gotten a scholarship to the University of Alabama, which kind of impressed me. And then before he was ever able to actually take the field, he was drafted into the Army and wound up being a tanker. And he fought the Nazis all the way across France into Germany as the commander of a Sherman tank. And he was just a dynamic guy. And for some reason, he kind of took me into his confidence as a kid when I didn't see him very often because he lived in Alabama. But when we would visit, he would talk to me about, I was interested in the war, you know, just, it was something that interested me. I wanted to know more about it. And there was a time when he sat down and talked to me and said, you know, Larry, the average German soldier said, we wanted to kill them simply because there was nothing else that we could do. It was kill or be killed. He said, but they were just ordinary people fighting for their country.
Who do you mean by they?
He was talking about the ordinary German soldiers.
Okay.
The people that, but what he was saying was that they had fought the Waffen-SS and they beat them. And he said that the Waffen-SS, who were hardcore Nazis, he said they were just plain evil. He said they were the most evil people I have ever met in my life. He said we saw the results of the things that they had done to the people. He said they had gone into villages and raped and murdered, you know, just wholesale. He said there was one village where they got all the people in the village into a church and burned the church down with them in it, simply because somebody had thrown a rock at one of their vehicles. And he said, you know, the French people would tell them stories about them, and he said it was almost unbelievable just how evil these people were. And that set me on a track. It took many years. In college, I took an interest in the development of the Third Reich. But the one thing I really didn't know about, or it wasn't really emphasized very much, was the occult beginnings of the Third Reich. And then we begin to see how these people turned out to be as evil as they were because of the influences that they had through the occult.
I'll pick up on that strain. The next thing I want to run by you, and this is very general and prefatorial. We all look at research. Everybody does. When you read something, in a sense, you're doing research.
Yeah.
And if you are doing a paper necessarily or an article or an essay or whatever, you can do a number of things. You can do just something that's subjective with the resources that support, I guess, what you believe is to be is the truth. But here's where I'm going with this. I can see, I mean, let's face it, the historical record, and that especially which is most accessible in libraries, at academic libraries, also in books that are available for purchase. I mean, and now we're really down to the last few mass publishing houses.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, the record that's there in those books, in academia, in popular interest, not necessarily the true record, but they got the high ground because they're backed, they're supported, mm-hmm. and nothing can happen to those books, no matter if they're great sellers or not. They're going to always be out there and shoved in your face.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also have works, and you know what I did with Theobald's book, The Final Secret of Pearl Harbor, where he's a rear admiral at Pearl, and he writes a book in 54, 9 years after the fact, and says, yeah, you know, they all knew that Pearl was going to get attacked. And, of course, people dump all over it. The book doesn't really get wide publication. So where am I going with all this? It comes down to this. When you really get down to the essence of everything, on two sides of a subject, where if I were to go back and forth with you or Phelps or somebody, you got your guys and I got my guys. But where do we find the truth? Is it somewhere in between? I don't know. But I would say this. Take in both, but then also use your brain. Think about the time if it's all possible. And look at actions and also common sense. I don't know. That may sound kind of general. But for instance, I mean, we talk about the founding fathers and all this other stuff, and that's not where we're going to today. But it's like, okay, so these guys were like, you know, all Christians, and they were like demigods. And then you take a look at what, you know, the Constitution itself or the way they behaved, and especially Jefferson, you know, who, like, wrote his own Bible. That's great. Well, not wrote it, I mean, but he excised what he didn't want. And you're like, who is this
guy? He wasn't egotistical or anything like that.
No. And it's like, don't give me that. So anyway, we're always going to have that, and I think you probably understand it as well. And by all means, hit me with this if you can. There's always going to be your guys and my guys. I would like to think that the truth is something that can be at least substantiated by when you take a look at the big picture and how nations and people behaved. You know, that's the end of it to me. What was the outcome physically? But
I think that it's something important, and you're right, you can never get to the total truth, and you can never cover totally a subject as broad as, you know, the origins of the Nazi Party and their aims, etc. But the best thing you can do, and this is something I learned in college in studying history, the best thing is to go to primary sources as much as possible and find out from their writings and from their speeches what they actually thought and what they actually said. And that's the best way to determine, you know, the truth or get as close to the truth as you can.
I will tell you where you're going to go in this series. Is something that never dawned on me. And this is kind of strange how it all happened. I had sat under a pastor out in Pittsburgh by the name of Bob Rosio.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize how much of a historian he was, but the church also supported a non-denominational school. But he wrote a number of books, and one of them was Hitler and the New Age.
Mm.
I read this in the spring of 94. And I didn't know about the New World Order or anything back then. But because of what he wrote, I never put it together. And I think this is what happens to a lot of, we'll just talk about Americans, and amongst them also those who are really Christian. Just how much evil plays a part in all that. And of course, you would say, well, duh. But think about this. I had not put that all together. I had not thought about the most occult, most powerful dark force there is on earth, and that is Satan. mm-hmm. that he would be involved in this.
Oh, very much so.
Yeah, but understand
leading
that.
Leading the pack, leading the charge.
Yeah. But the thing is, how many Christians, you know, it gets down to the point, it's like, does anybody here believe in Satan? You know, I mean, you talk about Satanists, you talk about Satan rituals and satanic rituals, and you think it's all druggy hippies and all this other stuff. But when you really pin a Christian down, it's like, do you really believe that Satan's working right now? And I don't know that you would get...
Man, he's working overtime right now to bring in his new world order, his world government.
And I would even say, as far as my experience goes, that with every war that's gone on, the evil side of what's running this place gets a little bit more manifest. And I think probably, and I'm going to throw it to you to answer this, but if that is true, that the level of evilness and the investment by Satan in characters, the major principles in wars, gets to become more and more obvious to the point where it really wasn't all that hidden with the Nazis. What do you think?
No, it really wasn't hidden. The Nazi Party was really the result of a great deal of occult influence. In fact, I'll read a passage from Hitler. It's quoted from one of his speeches, and it's quoted in a book, The Spear of Destiny, by Trevor Ravenscroft, who's an English writer. Creation is not yet completed. Man must pass through many further stages of metamorphosis. Post-Atlantean man is already in a state of degeneration and decline, barely able to survive. All creative forces will be concentrated in a new species. The two types of man, the old and the new, will evolve rapidly in different directions. One will disappear from the face of the earth, the other will flourish. This is the real motive behind the National Socialist movement. Well, what Hitler was trying to say there, what he was saying there, was that they were bringing about a new man, a new type of man, and a lot, or the majority of the Nazi ideology, as far as the racism that they perpetrated, was a result of occult secret societies and their works and their ideas. And in particular, his main influence, or the influence on the secret societies that influenced him, and he was a member of one of the most evil secret societies in Germany, and it's the Thule Society. At any rate, that society was based on the teachings of Madame Helena Petrovna Blavatsky. And I can read some of Madame Blavatsky's ideas about Lucifer, strangely enough. We can go into the root races later, and her book, The Secret Doctrine. Madame Blavatsky says in The Secret Doctrine, Lucifer represents life, thought, progress, civilization, liberty, independence. Lucifer is the Logos, the serpent, the Savior. She also goes on to say, it is Satan who is the God of our planet and the only God. And she says, the celestial virgin, which thus becomes the mother of gods and devils at one time, one and the same time, for she is the ever-loving, beneficent deity. But in antiquity and reality, Lucifer, or Luciferius, is the name. Lucifer is the divine and terrestrial light, the Holy Ghost and Satan at one and the same time. Well, let's face it, good old Madame Blavatsky was nothing more than a Satanist, a Luciferian in their terminology. And beginning in the mid-19th century, there was a great deal of Eastern mystical concepts and the concepts of the Western mystery schools and mystery religions that were kind of all jammed into a hodgepodge that Madame Blavatsky put into a book called The Secret Doctrine. I just quoted a few things there from it. I'll read to you from a book by Nicholas Goodrich Clark, who's a well-known English historian, about Madame Blavatsky and the cults. says, occultism has its basis in a religious way of thinking, the roots of which stretch back into antiquity and which may be described as a Western esoteric tradition. Its principal ingredients have been identified as Gnosticism, the Hermetic treatises on alchemy and magic, Neoplatonism, and the Kabbalah, all originating in the Eastern Mediterranean area during the first few centuries A.D. Germany boasted several renowned scholar magicians in the Renaissance and a number of secret societies devoted to Rosicrucianism. Theosophy and alchemy also flourished there from the 17th to the 19th century. Madame Blavatsky's first book, Isis Unveiled, was less an outline of her new religion than a rambling tirade against the rationalist and materialist culture of modern Western civilization. She drew upon a range of secondary sources treating of pagan mythology and mystery religions, Gnosticism, the Hermetica, and the arcane lore of the Renaissance scholars, the Rosicrucians, and other secret fraternities. W. E. Coleman has shown that her work comprised a sustained and frequent plagiarism of about 100 contemporary texts, chiefly relating to ancient and exotic religions, demonology, Freemasonry, and the case of spiritualism. Madame Blavatsky discerned the unique source of their inspiration, the occult lore of ancient Egypt. Her fascination with Egypt as the fount of all wisdom arose from her enthusiastic reading of the English author Sir Edward Bulwer Lytton. His novel, The Last Days of Pompeii, has been conceived of as a narrative of the impact of the Isis cult in Rome during the first century A.D. His later works, Zanoni, A Strange Story, and The Coming Race, now that's important because the novel The Coming Race was the basis for the establishment of the Vril Society, which was a secret society within the Thule Society. And said it's dedicated to occult knowledge in a way which exercised an extraordinary fascination on the romantic mind of the 19th century. The secret doctrine claimed to describe the activities of God from the beginning of one period of universal creation until its end, a cyclical process which continues indefinitely over and over again. Madame Blavatsky illustrated the stages of the cosmic cycle with a variety of esoteric symbols, including triangles and swastikas. A further important theosophical tenet was the belief in reincarnation and karma, also taken from Hinduism. Besides its racial emphasis, theosophy also stressed the principle of elitism and the value of a hierarchy. Blavatsky claims she received her initiation into the doctrines from two exalted Mahatmas, or masters, called Maurya and Kuthumi, who dwelt in a remote and secret Himalayan fastness. These adepts were not gods, but rather advanced members of her own evolutionary group who decided to impart their wisdom to the rest of Aryan mankind through their chosen representative, Madame Blavatsky. Well, as far as I'm concerned, Madame Blavatsky was nothing more than a Luciferian twit who wrote a very long and rambling mythological history of racism. And in it, I mean, as far as I know, there have been no real scholars, no real historians or anthropologists or geologists who can back up the claims of her her belief in these root races. I could read a little more of an account of what the theory of the root races were. It's from a book called Hitler's Racial Ideology by Jackson Spielvogel and David Redlich. In her esoteric work, especially The Secret Doctrine, originally published in 1888, Blavatsky emphasized the concept of races as paramount in the development of human history. According to Blavatsky, there are seven root races of mankind, with each root race containing seven sub-races. The present root race is the fifth, the Aryan, and was preceded by a fourth or Atlantean race. The Aryans evolved from the fifth sub-race of the Atlanteans. According to Blavatsky, and this is quote, the Aryan race was born and developed in the far north, though after the sinking of the continent of Atlantis, its tribes immigrated south into Asia. The Aryans, following a migratory pattern that went south and west from Asia, ultimately created the great Hindu, Persian, Greco-Roman, and later European cultures. And it says here, Hitler, like his party ideologist, Alfred Rosenberg, also claimed Aryan origins for all these cultures. It goes on to say, each root race is seen by Blavatsky as being constituted differently in a physical and spiritual sense. And this is from Hitler. Hitler was greatly influenced by Blavatsky. In fact, he was greatly influenced by the occult in general.
Mm-hmm.
But he says, and this is from Hermann Rauschning, who was a friend of Hitler, and kind of kept a running diary of what Hitler said. The pursuit of the random path of the intelligence, we learned, was the real defection of man from his divine mission. To have magic insight was apparently Hitler's idea of the goal of human progress. He himself felt that he already had the rudiments of this gift. He attributed his success and his future eminence to this. Excuse me. A savant of Munich had also written some curious stuff about the prehistoric world, about forms of perception and supernatural powers. There was the eye of the Cyclops, or median eye, the organ of magic perception of the infinite, now reduced to a rudimentary pineal gland. Speculations of this sort fascinated Hitler, and he would sometimes be entirely wrapped up in them. He saw his own remarkable career as a confirmation of hidden powers. He saw himself as chosen for superhuman task, as the prophet of the rebirth of man in a new form. And goes on the article to say, Blavatsky had helped to foster anti-Semitism, which is perhaps one of the reasons her esoteric work was so rapidly accepted in German circles. She sharply differentiated Aryan and Jewish religion. The Aryans were the most spiritual people on earth. For them, religion was an everlasting lodestar. For the Jews, religion was grounded on mere calculation. They had a religion of hate and malice toward everything and everyone. Jewish materialism and selfishness contrasted strongly with Aryan spirituality and selflessness. This dualism is dramatically echoed in Hitler in the following passages. Two worlds face one another, the men of God and the men of Satan. Interesting. The Jew is the anti-man, the creature of another God. He must have come from another root race. I set the Aryan and the Jew over against each other, and if I call one of them a human being, I must call the other something else. The two are as widely separated as man and beast. Not that I would call the Jew a beast. He's much further from the beast than we Aryans. He's a creature outside of nature and alien to nature. Well, we kind of get the impression there he doesn't like the Jews.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so virulent. I mean, it's one thing to dislike or hate people, but this just goes into, kind of a realm that I don't think the world had ever really seen before. Go ahead.
No, I was going to throw this in. With regard to what Rosio had written along your lines, He quoted Meister Eckhart as saying, I shall have influenced history more than any other German. Follow Hitler.
Exactly.
I have initiated him into the secret doctrine, opened the center's division, and given him means to communicate with the powers.
Exactly.
And then Rosio just said, he established communication with Lucifer, from whom he openly coveted possession, entering into the service of Satan through a Luciferian initiation. Now, it was also in this book, too, where later on, again, Rosio was just researching what's out there. He said that when they broke into the bunker, they found what? How many Buddhist monks dead?
Yeah, yeah.
So he had those guys doing whatever they were doing just for the mojo he thought came from them. So.
Yeah, exactly. The SS had several expeditions to Tibet, the Himalayas, to, gather information on the Aryan race. They also did the same thing. They went up to Greenland and Iceland, to try to find Thule.
And they also went down to Antarctica.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that thing with Thule, and I know you've been there also. It's interesting because, being Scandinavian, that's kind of like in their mythology or legend or whatever you want to call it as well.
Exactly, Norse mythology.
And there was always this thinking that the good came out of the north.
Mm-hmm.
The south is seen as being, I think, somewhat evil. Just as left-handedness is seen as being evil, if you will, mm-hmm. and right-handed isn't. Did you know that, by the way?
Well, I knew that the Scandinavian Norse myth, Germanic Scandinavian Norse myth, did talk about the north as being good.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know about left-handed, right-handed. I kind of like picked that up as a, a superstition.
Left-handed
people were looked upon as strange.
I know. Yeah, but I think the root word is sinister. It comes like from sinister.
Yeah.
So I know. Yeah, lefties always get a bad rap. You know what's bad with me is I'm not ambidextrous, but I'm dexterous.
You know, I'd give my right arm to be ambidextrous.
There you go. We get our Dremel out of this.
Ba-ba-pow.
Yeah, you're not above it, are you? That's great.
Gosh.
But
I gotta have a little fun with this because it's an awfully dark subject.
Yeah, I mean, it could definitely dent your brain for some time afterward.
Well, let's talk about the concept of Lucifer and the occult, if you don't mind.
No, I don't mind, but I don't mean to pin you down on this too. But
no, it's important that we kind of establish this stuff, and where the actual, origins are.
Well,
and after I talk about Lucifer a little bit, I'll go into talking about the secret societies that were prevalent in Hitler's day and the Thule Society, which he belonged to, and then the Vril Society. And there's another one that people probably aren't aware of, which was it went kind of like this. The top society that everyone knew about was the Thule Society. Within the Thule Society was a secret society known as the Vril Society. And then within the Vril Society, there was one called the Black Sun. So they had not only were they secret societies, but they had a pyramidal, structure.
But you see, this also brings up the point, which I think bears a saying, and that is, I was very heavy on the Freemasons until the point when I realized that a lot of the occult symbolism that now resides apparently in Masonry, in high degree Masonry, has been with us for all time. It isn't like they created it. Also, there's no doubt in my mind that a lot of Masons don't know what's going on, especially the Blue Lodge.
No, they don't. They're kept blinded. I mean, Albert Pike even said that in one of his letters to a particular a governing board of the Masons. I forget the name of it. They have some high sounding jive title for it, but as they do with everything else, the exalted this and the holy that. And, but anyway, he wrote that it's important for us to keep the public in general and the people in the lower levels, blinded as to what the ultimate secret is.
I think he wrote that in Morals and Dogma.
Yeah, he may have.
But you see, this is also the case, and I would say, with the CFR. Okay, you got some people in there who are heavy-duty types. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of what you would call porch members.
Right.
If you will, and that's
what
I think.
Yeah, that's what they call them.
Yeah.
That's what they call them in the Masons.
Yeah, I mean, they don't know what's going on. They don't really want to go that far.
Yeah.
But now that you mentioned it about the Thule Society and that you have subdivisions, of course. I mean, so there's some that don't know what else is going on. I'm not making a justification for it, but I think you'll find more sinister types, the more you could call it going up vertically or whatever, or inside a core. And they're the ones who really know what's shaken, and that isn't necessarily.
Well, that's really the way that secret societies work. It's like a series of steps, and only the esoteric, inner circle really knows what the secret is. In fact, I was kind of writing down my impressions of the way secret societies work, They actually the old mystery religions, which is where Freemasonry comes from. It actually comes from the Knights Templar, which was a secret society. But at any rate, there are two forms of worshiping, and that is in the very ancient times, in Babylonian times, and Egyptian times, etc. They would have the priesthood would it was a form of sun worship and the sun and stars. But inside there was an esoteric level where there was a different type of worship for the adepts. And then they had a knowledge of a true God, which was one of the, you know, areas of the secret. And those who know were sworn to secrecy. So they kept anyone who was not an adept from knowing what the secret was. And they were the ones who knew how to solve all the problems and knew what was going on. But the real secret of Mystery Babylon, I think, was how to control everyone else. That's the real secret. And also that Lucifer is their God. And, you know, they couched it under sun worship, but all along, I think, from the time that mankind, you know, from the time that man sinned and fell from grace and began to develop religion, in the secret societies which ran those religions, I think it was all about the worship of Satan, the worship of Lucifer, as they would call him.
Are you differentiating between the two? As I've come to understand it coming out of the mouths of those who pursue this.
Yeah.
That they look, this is the way I've got it, and I'm so, unfortunately, most of these characters are the ones who pop up on Coast to Coast.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they talk about Satan being the real bad guy and Lucifer, well, he's just a fun loving spirit. You know, kind of.
I don't
just,
buy that.
Huh?
I don't buy that Lucifer was a.
No, but that's what a lot of them are pitching.
Yeah.
So
well, you know, they're Luciferians themselves, and there's
right.
always, I think they're deluded. Really, you know, it's like, they'll tell you, I've heard, you know, a lot of the Masonic cover as well, Lucifer just represents the intellect, you know, the higher being of, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, well, I think Lucifer is an entity, okay? I think Lucifer is the one that we call Satan, you know? And it's just a now. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong, you know. But I don't think either one. If there are two different entities, well, I don't think either one of them has the good of mankind at heart.
I think when you get it from the societies that worship Lucifer and the light, it is a deliberate play on what would you say, stealing Jesus' thunder in a sense.
Exactly.
Because light is a decent thing. You think of light as a good thing. Well, the way they play it out, it's very humanistic and therefore not necessarily Christian at all, whatever that means. But I have heard them say, I mean, I remember starkly that, oh, no, Lucifer is just kind of like you and me and, you know, just kind of gets worked up sometimes. And I think that's how they sell it. Now, whether or not they really believe it or not, I don't know. I would assume some do. And I mean, even Albert Pike played off that also in Morals and Dogma. So, okay. I mean, there's. And then some think that Lucifer was, I guess, how should I say this? That Lucifer, the term, is falsely attributed to Satan. And I won't go any further than that.
Yeah, I've heard all that, and I don't buy it. I mean, I really don't. All I know is that in the Bible, Lucifer is the devil.
Okay.
That's all I know. And I go by the Bible. I believe in the Bible. I'm not into anything mystic. In fact, I think that's a great mistake for people to get involved in mysticism. I know that there's nothing that's mystic about Christianity, and that's where people really go wrong. No, Jesus said in John 18 and 20, I just looked this one up real quickly, I spoke openly to the world. I ever taught in the synagogue and in the temple whither the Jews always resort, and in secret I have said nothing. I think mysticism and all its hidden realities and hidden secrets and all that just don't belong, you know. They don't belong in Christianity, and they're evil, as far as I'm concerned, because they lead to the manipulation of others and to doing harm to others through manipulating them.
Oh, I agree. There are some who believe it is strictly, how should we say this, an academic situation. I don't necessarily. And when I look at certain ghouls that are prominent and internet radio and everything.
Yeah.
It's like I can do without the hidden knowledge. It's okay. I don't need the esoteric. I'm fine without it. That's all right. I can sort it with those types for a while, and I realize, even though they might have been decent to me and vice versa, that actually in the end all you do is and I made a mistake this way and give them credibility. So my point is, no, there's no consorting with dark and light together. And so I agree with you. It's like, yeah, you know what? I'll tell you what. Fade that esoteric stuff. I'm okay with the Bible.
Me too.
But without beating it over the head for other people, you know, do what you got to do. But let me bring you back to the whole idea of what was going on with Nazism and,
sure,
like you said, Blavatsky and Luciferianism.
Sure. I'd like to read a little summary here of Hitler and the Occult, written in a book called Hitler and the New Age by a man, Philip Jones. And it's a fairly good summary. Hitler was initiated into the mysteries of the occult at a young age. He attended a Benedictine monastery near his home in Austria.
That'll do it to you.
Yeah.
Sorry.
That's enough to blow anybody out of the water. Anyway, the occult interest Hitler gained in this school stayed with him all of his adult life and helped to shape his future spiritual philosophy. During his years as an aspiring artist and or architect, and some would say bum, in Vienna, I just threw that in there. He often frequented occult bookstores and libraries, acquainting himself with the mysteries of metaphysics and making the acquaintance of occultic local adepts. He was fascinated by the theories of transcendent states of consciousness and mind expansion, and devoted much of what little money he had in his time to the pursuit of higher states of consciousness. Impatient with such methods as yoga, astrology, Eastern and Western paths, he accelerated the progress by supplementing meditation with drugs. He used mescaline to transport himself to the desired higher states of consciousness, which enabled him to experience what occultists term the Akashic Record, a demonic version of historical and future events. In other words, he was seeing into the future, but colored by demonic vision. His aim in taking this accelerated path was to gain a perspective on his own future destiny. Hitler believed he had made contact with Lucifer and openly coveted possession. In 1938, he was said to have commented, "I have seen the Antichrist. He is cruel and intrepid. He frightened me." Well, he would have frightened me too, but this idiot went ahead and kept pursuing it. So, you know, sometimes I wonder about the condition of someone's mind to know that what they're dealing with is evil and cruel and could do them great harm, but they continue to pursue it, I guess, out of the desire to have power.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't doubt at all that there's a true communion there. And also, I mean, you're dealing with the most powerful entity on earth right now and until an appointed time. He's
right.
Also a great liar.
Right.
And, of course, those who want to seek, I guess, to do that, his bidding in his service, believe there's going to be a payoff down the road. And I agree with them, but it's not going to be the one that they think there's going to be. But certainly, they've experienced, well, I mean, take a look at Hitler. I mean, that's an example far beyond, you know, I would hate to say the garden variety type.
Oh, yeah.
But, well, and I don't want to misquote this, but there was somebody in Hitler's inner circle who said that he thought him rather unremarkable in a lot of ways, but so he felt that he had to be invested by something to lift him up to the heights, obviously, you know, to which he ruled. And I really have no problem believing that whatsoever. I mean, take a look at him.
Quite a few people that thought he was demonically possessed.
Well, that's it in a nutshell.
Yeah.
Yeah, that'll do it.
There were, I've read accounts and I've seen interviews with people who had gone to Hitler rallies. In fact, one of them that I saw that was very interesting to me was an interview with a professor of history at the University of Michigan, a man named George Moss, M-O-S-S-E. Anyway, he was a Jew, and for some unknown reason, as a young adolescent, he had sneaked out of the house and gone to a Hitler rally. And he said, "I cannot explain to you the power that this man had." He said, "He said there was really nothing remarkable about him. You know, he seemed he wasn't particularly handsome or erudite but he said when he started to speak, he had a power that you just couldn't explain. And he said, you know, of course, my parents had known that I'd gone to this rally that, you know, had beat me half to death. But he said that it was just something he had to do because he had heard so much about it. And he said, I can't explain this power that the man had. Well, I can explain it. And the only way I can explain it is that it has to be a supernatural power, and it has to be from a Luciferian source. I mean, I think he was demonically possessed, and that's what gave him the great power and the attraction that he had.
Yeah, I would agree. Absolutely.
You know, we were talking earlier about the levels, Freemasonry and other, occult orders. I'd like to read some stuff from Alex Constantine, which is along those lines.
Sure.
And what Constantine contends is that Freemasonry is not really anywhere near the top of the pyramid as far as the occult and the secret orders. But I'll read a couple of things that he said here. Adolf Hitler and his inner circle of Nazis called the Holocaust the greatest and most powerful dance of death of all time. Then he goes on to say, perhaps the real difference between a shaman-informed pagan ritual and a satanic ritual lies in the consent of any party. A victim definition is the unconsenting prey of the predator, and any such ritual intends to create only darkness. Hitler himself said, this is, he calls Hitler a Rosicrucian front man. The old beliefs, this is Hitler speaking, the old beliefs will be brought back to honor again. The whole secret knowledge of the divine, of the demonic, we will wash off the Christian veneer. I want to see in the eyes of youth the gleam of the beast. That's Hitler speaking. And Constantine talked quite a bit about the Rosicrucian order, and he talks about a book that was released in the early part of the 20th century called The Secret Doctrine of the Rosicrucians, which was written by a senior Rosicrucian himself. He was threatened by a lawsuit and also threatened with death for having written this thing. I don't know the outcome of that. I don't know whether they got to him or not. I do know that they suppressed the book at one point. But anyway, the book, The Secret Doctrine of Rosicrucian, says, the possession of knowledge unaccompanied by manifest and expression in action is like the hoarding of precious metals. Forget not to use it. He goes on to talk about magical powers. And Constantine says, according to their dogma, it is the mission of the Rosicrucian to initiate, to assist in the evolution of human consciousness. Says, however, their evolutionary theories are fundamentally racist. According to their beliefs, each race is of a higher or lesser degree of consciousness. One race may only step forward to a higher plane when the lower race is annihilated. By whatever means, it is their unfortunate destiny to endure. As theories of reincarnation are also central to Rosicrucian belief system, such racial genocides are not considered to be negative, but in fact most positive. And from the book, The Secret Doctrine of the Rosicrucians, the individuals of any subrace who have outstripped their fellows in spiritual pursuits are still bound by race ties to their brothers until the great body of the subraces are up to the position of the individual. Great convulsions of nature destroy practical traces of the preceding civilization and leave but few survivors. Well, you can see in that type of rhetoric, you can see is very similar to what Hitler and, of course, Blavatsky was talking about. In fact, a lot of people believe that Blavatsky was kind of the front woman for the Rosicrucians. And here's something interesting that Constantine says here. The higher ranks of Freemasonry are only the lower ranks of the exclusive Rosicrucian orders. The Knights of Malta, the Knights Templar, the Priory of Sion, etc., are instructed in these occult beliefs, which means many powerful people have been conditioned to internalize these dehumanizing values. At first glance, it may appear that the Catholic monastic orders are at odds with Rosicrucianism. However, the historical civilizing and educational mission of these is rooted in the same beliefs. It is believed by scholars that the inner circle teachings of the Jesuits and Rosicrucianism are the same thing. In fact, the Orthodox Roman Catholic Church has always been fundamentally linked to the Rosicrucian secret church. Traditional Catholicism's obsession with sex is also a result of the Vatican's knowledge of the secret teachings. He goes on to say, according to aristocratic historian Sir Lawrence Gardner, the British contingent of the Imperial and Royal Dragon Court embodies the Knights Templar of St. Anthony and resides within the Rosicrucian Anglican fraternity, revealing that Satanism and Rosicrucianism are not so much distant cousins as close relatives. Perhaps this goes a long way to explaining why the Catholic order of the Knights Templar worship an idol called Baphomet, a goat-headed and hoofed androgynous figure with female breasts, penis, and a pentagram on his forehead. The massively wealthy Knights, gold bullion, was named for the Templar creator Godefroy de Bouillon, are widely credited with originating the capitalist banking system and the corporate model, and were eventually hounded by the Church's Inquisition, allegedly for infanticide, sodomy, and witchcraft, although their demise did save the Church and many princes of Europe from repaying great debt. However, many Templars relocated to England and Scotland, where their tradition continued with the formation of Freemasonry. That was a mouthful.
Yeah, well, let me hit with a couple of things if I could.
Sure, sure.
It was through a discussion with Liam, mm-hmm. but we talked about stuff, and he said, and I started to get the idea. All right, remember how we talked about that there are porch members for everything?
Yeah.
Whether the CFR or whatever, there's some who just don't know what's going on the inside. And I'm not saying that's bad at all. I'm just, that's the way it is. I started to also think that, in a sense, that Freemasonry might have been held up as the pinata, which you could bash, bagmen, if you will, for something else. That, in a sense, they were, if you will, porch members of something much greater. That something much greater, Liam seemed to indicate, especially over in Europe, are the Rosies.
I think that's exactly correct. I think there's evidence that points to that. It's when you consider it to become a member of the Knights of Malta, which is considered one of the very highest of the occult secret societies, and it's you have to be an aristocrat. You have to be extremely wealthy. When we look at the Masons, I mean, you can be a middle-class or working-class guy, and you can, you know, apply to become a Mason and become one. Well, you can't just get into these other orders, you know, without being among the very elite.
Well, if I have this right, the Knights of Malta, their headquarters is inside Vatican City.
I believe that's correct, yeah. And did you know that they are considered to be a sovereign nation as well?
That was the idea, too. And get where this came from. It was when the Today Show took a trip over to Rome. Mm-hmm. And there was this like little secret keyhole you could look into.
Right.
And that, and on the other side was the headquarters of the, they would call themselves the Sovereign Knights. The Sovereign, mm-hmm. what is it? The Sovereign Military Order of Malta, SMOM, or the Knights of Malta. So, yeah, you're right. And, of course, they found their way, and I'm sure you're going to hit this later on, they found their way into, I think, the revamping of intelligence agencies in many places, including the United States.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I have something along those lines. And Seymour Hersh recently made a public statement about the Knights of Malta, which really surprised me. There's an article which I kept from it's from Seymour Hersh Unleashed by Blake Hounshell in Foreign Policy Magazine, which is not a magazine very many people read, but guys like me who are doing research
right,
kind of get a hold of that.
Now, I tell you what, you can find it in academic libraries. I've read it, yep.
Yeah. He said, Hersh then alleged that General Stanley McChrystal, who headed the JSOC, Joint Chiefs of Staff, before briefly becoming the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan, and his successor, Vice Admiral, William McRaven, as well as many others within the JSOC, are also members of, or at least supporters of, the Knights of Malta.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Hounshell goes on to say, Hirsch may have been referring to the Sovereign Order of Malta, a Roman Catholic organization committed to the defense of the faith and assistance to the poor and suffering. Yeah, right. According to his website.
Well,
he goes on to say, Hirsch goes on to say, many of them are members of Opus Dei. They do see what they're doing, and this is not a typical attitude among some military. It's a crusade, literally. They see themselves as the protectors of Christians. They're protecting them from the Muslims, as in the 13th century, and this is their function. They have little insignias, these coins they pass around among each other, which are crusader coins. They have insignia that reflect the whole nation that notion that this is a culture war. Right now, there's a tremendous, tremendous amount of anti-Muslim feeling in the military community.
Well, yeah, that's that no doubt is being manufactured as we speak.
Exactly. I mean, we're going to have a new crusade.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really what it's, I mean, that's what it's building up to, Biz. I mean, if people can't see that, I'm sorry, but, I mean, if you really look the facts in the face, it's just like in the Middle Ages when they went around trying to get a crusade. They had people that they would send into the towns that would start talking about the evils of the Muslims and why the Roman Catholic Church had to go to the Holy Land and take it back. And they would whip up enthusiasm and they would get some of the peasants armed right there on the spot with whatever they could come up with, and they would march on down the road and take them in as the cannon fodder, if you will, for the Crusades.
Let me take you back, if I could, when we were talking about the Rosicrucians and to this very point that you just made right now. First of all, also, the Rosicrucians are an older order than the Masons.
Mm-hmm.
Also, they were begotten in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
You can go to a website, www.soul.org, and that will be billed as the authentic Rosicrucian fraternity in the Americas and the Isles of the Sea. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Also, if you remember, and it says, like the first paragraph, it says, welcome to the authentic Rosicrucian fraternity. Let's see, that was first instituted in Germany in 1614. The fraternity brought together into one organization the various associations of individuals previously known as the Hermeticists, Pythagoreans, excuse me, Magi.
Pythagoreans?
Huh?
Is that like Pythagoras?
Yeah, you know, and I fell geometry twice. So when I see that word, I start going, you know, Mo Larry Cheese, Mo Larry Cheese.
You know, my teacher had a really thick Texas accent. You never know why that is, but she would always pronounce it, and she was a good math teacher, really smart lady, but she'd always go, the Pythagorean theorem.
There you go. I am.
I didn't know until I got older.
There it is.
The guy was Pythagoras, you know, but hey, right. Pythagorean.
The other groups in this are the Magi, the Platonists, the Gnostics, the Alchemists, and the Paracelsians. Now, if you might remember, when I read that part of the book, the Meniscus Chronicles.
Yes, sir.
That was written under a pseudonym, and it was from this center of the German Rosicrucian element in the United States, and it's in Quakersville, Pennsylvania. Do I have that right? Quakersville? Yeah, it's Quakersville. My point is that they consider themselves, obviously, the most erudite. And I had a discussion with Pilot Pete years ago, and I was talking about Rosicrucianism, and he said, well, do you remember Mrs. So-and-so was one? Somebody on the block. And I'm like, no. Oh, he goes, oh, yeah, oh, yeah. Now, she used to go to worship, whatever this means. I don't know if you had one of these in your neighborhood. I did. The Ethical Cultural Society.
The what now?
Yeah. The Ethical Cultural Society.
No, we didn't have one of those. We had a Masonic lodge down the street from, I lived in a small town.
Well, there's no
big. And one of my forebears hangs in the place. It not literally hangs, but his portrait hangs in the place because he started the lodge. When I was a kid, they tried to recruit me. They're not supposed to recruit, but they do as far as De Molay, which is their auxiliary. You know, and I didn't know for years that Jacques De Molay was burned at the stake.
The stake in France,
you know?
Yeah.
And it was obvious, you know, I mean, if that isn't a connection to the Knights Templar, you know, you name your youth auxiliary organization, you know, the De Molay. The guy came to a house and wanted a young man who was a member of the group and wanted to talk to my folks and me about joining. My dad goes, well, I'm sorry, but my son's not going to join a secret society. And the guy goes, oh, no, this is not a secret society. He goes, well.
Yeah.
My dad goes, well, if you're a Mason, it's a secret society. That was kind of the end of the discussion.
Well, I find
fortunately, our house didn't get burned down or anything.
No. When I was a teenager, I was a ringer on the De Molay softball team.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know if I ever told you that. And then after the game is over and stuff, this kid comes over to me. He's going, well, are you going to I think he called it the enclave or the conclave or something. I'm like, no, I got to go on vacation with my parents. I'm going, please, what is this? I got to get out of here. You know, and the other thing is they used to set pins in a Masonic lodge.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the old days, you know, they didn't have the old AMF, pin
yeah.
setters.
Yeah,
yeah, we sat on this little flat piece of board straddling two lanes. Mm-hmm. And then you had a pedal you stepped on, and all the prongs came up, and he would set the pins.
Yeah.
But when the guys got drunk, they used to try to hit you with the ball while you were in the pit. That wasn't a very Masonic thing to do, I didn't think.
It may have been actually a very Masonic thing to do.
Yeah, you know? If you can hit the pin boy, it's 10 points, yeah. But going back to this this whole thing with the Rosicrucians and everything, and that is they consider themselves the true order that has morphed over here from Germany, where there's another center, I believe, that's somewhere out, I think, in San Jose. And they kind of want to be, they don't want to be known as that.
Mm-hmm.
But when I read the Minister's Chronicles, in that, they posit a scenario about how the United States will be invaded. And I'm telling you, it is chillingly, I think, plausible. But do you also remember that I got those pages from the 38th Conclave or something like that back in 1913?
Mm-hmm.
And I read them on air. I got them from Poker Face.
Yeah.
And in it, it talked about how when Mexico was brought back into North America or United States, that the all-seeing eye will be set upon the pyramid, and then the pyramid will be complete. Because they see Mexico as a Western Egypt.
Yeah, I've read that in Rosicrucian literature, not sure where I got this, and I'm maybe incorrect, but they believe that the United States will not, that the capstone, the pyramidal structure with
right.
the Eye of Horus or whatever, the capstone will not be put on the pyramid until the United States is linked back with Mexico.
That's exactly right. That's exactly what he wrote. And this is a climber who his antecedents were involved. I think, in fact, that one of them was a signer on the Constitution. It's a big landed Pennsylvania family.
Mm-hmm.
So, So the reason I brought this whole thing up with Pilot Pete, not to get too far afield, I guess we have, but... And that
okay.
is, he said, well, you know, Mrs. So-and-so was always was a Rosicrucian. And I'm saying, well, Pete, you know, I mean, it's, again, she doesn't have to be involved with all this blah, blah, blah. But the thing is, they also were very, I thought, erudite organization that prized education, I'm sorry, much as the Jesuits do. You can't get a better education in college, I think, in the United States than going to a Jesuit facility. And so that's just the way it is. So I think the Masons have gotten a real bad deal in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. I mean, the Knights of Malta, I believe, is in the higher degrees, but I think
oh, yeah.
it's Scottish Rite, not
yeah.
York, for whatever that
is. Let's talk about the Knights of Malta a little bit. And,
sure.
I've got some interesting information here, again, from Constantine, Alex Constantine. He writes here in an article about Rosicrucianism, and... he says, when Hitler's attempt to create a third empire failed, many leading Nazis escaped through the Knights of Malta and the Vatican rat run to the Americas.
Mm-hmm.
Far from disappearing, the Nazi movement and its racist ideology became a force both at grassroots and elite levels. Street-level neo-Nazism is particularly interesting for its overt use of Christian and biblical rhetoric. However, this is hardly surprising when the most powerful of neo-Nazi elite secret societies are directly linked to the Holy Roman Catholic Church, specifically the Knights of Malta, the Italian Masonic Lodge P2,
yeah.
and Holy Roman Empire Restorationist. The Priory of Sion, have all been proved to be linked to the hierarchy of the Vatican. Global members of these fascist groups participate at the highest level of the military, international politics, and finance. Well, we just found out earlier from Hirsch that very high-level people in the American military are linked in with the Knights of Malta, and some of them are Knights of Malta. But anyway, it says P2 Propaganda 2 are perhaps the most visible and are named after the propaganda machine of Joseph Goebbels that effectively mind-controlled the German people into believing their Rosicrucian racist ideology that led to the Holocaust. And then he goes on to say, it is widely known that Pope John Paul I demanded resignation from Vatican insiders who were members of P2 and were involved with major money laundering for the mafia through the Vatican Bank. He also planned a complete reshuffle of the staff and the power structure of the Vatican. The next night, he was found dead in his room with a list of names scattered over his body and was promptly buried without an autopsy. Those listed were retained and many were promoted to positions of more responsibility and power, including Chicago's Bishop Paul Marcinkus, who handled Vatican investments and who eluded a suspicious Italian police by remaining within the Vatican's walls. P2, like Hitler's own SS, are the elite of the international neo-Nazi movement. Yet, like Hitler and his occult inner circle, P2 are the ground troops of an even more powerful, hierarchical elite. Britain's respected newspaper, The Guardian, portrayed the structure of P2 as a pyramid beneath a pyramid. Its grand master, while at the apex of the P2 pyramid, was only at the base of the controlling power structure. It was revealed by a former member of P2, Mino Pecorelli, that the organization was ultimately controlled by the Knights of Malta and their allies within the CIA. Following this revelation, Pecorelli, like so many that have spoken out before him, was found dead. Shortly after P2's Roberto Calvi, who had handled Vatican finances and faced corruption charges, was found hanging under Blackfriars Bridge in London. Well, it kind of shows you what will happen to you if you mess with these guys.
Well, what I find interesting also is that that the order goes back to Germany
mm-hmm.
once again. And it gets really muddied, and we're not going to do that here.
Yep.
But, you know, on face, the Catholic Church will have nothing to do with Freemasonry.
Mm-hmm.
But then you look behind the scenes and you wonder.
Oh, yeah.
And then, of course, the Knights of Columbus were created supposedly as some place where the Catholics could go so they didn't go to Freemasonry.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. They're all alive and well.
All linked. They're all linked, and they all have really, as far as I'm concerned, very similar goals, if not exactly the same goal.
And also, their roots for some, I mean, well, what we've talked about is almost exclusively coming out of Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Not a rap on the German people whatsoever, but it just seems to have been a hotbed, more or less, there.
It really was, and when you consider the relationship with Germany to the Roman Catholic Church, which was the Roman Catholic Church in the First World War especially saw Germany as a military arm of the church. You know, the church wanted to punish France for its anti-clericalism, and of course they wanted to punish Britain for being a Protestant, you know, nation.
Yeah, but you know, all right, can I stop you right there just for a second?
Sure.
Think about all we've talked about and what you come across and I've come across.
Mm-hmm.
That whole split, I think, was more cosmetic.
Maybe than, so.
Yeah, and real. I mean, because, okay, fine. Henry can't get divorced, so now we create the Anglican Church, and what is it? It's Catholicism. I mean, who are you kidding? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So we call
yeah.
it Anglicanism? All right, great. Okay, that's a different religion, fine.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't really think it was, and you know yourself that the
well,
Vatican...
Well, you know, Henry VIII just got pissed off because he couldn't marry the people he wanted to marry, and
yeah,
decided to create his own church. And
but if I were to say to you, I mean, in what city in Europe would you do you believe, based on what you come across, has the most direct connection to the Vatican?
Most direct connection to the Vatican.
Of all the cities in Europe, which one seems to be most tied to at the hip to the Vatican? And
you
Rome?
Mean other than Rome?
Yes. Say London.
Yeah, really. I don't know how to answer that, Biz.
Say London.
Well, I was going to say London, and I thought, well, that's the answer to the quiz, but...
No, and, no. I mean, wait, what city did Calvi wind up being?
I lost on Jeopardy, baby.
All right, I have to form it in a question, right? What is London?
Sorry.
Hello.
Sorry about that. I see what you're talking about, and in particular, the city of London, which is not...
Inside.
Is not a governmental body.
Well, they are the to bankers. Themselves.
Yeah, the, yeah, the under themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny
it's interesting how all these really powerful organizations have their own national sovereignty, isn't it?
There you go.
The Vatican,
exactly.
The Malta.
The City of London.
City of London.
Inside London. The Vatican City inside Rome.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this isn't a coincidence. This is the
you
way
know,
it's
the Italian police really wanted to try to go after the people in P2, but they were hampered at every turn by the Vatican. And the Vatican wins. You know, the Vatican just brushes aside the Italian police, and they do what they want to do.
And another time, too, if you want to bring this to a close at this point, I don't know if you want to, but, I mean, as far as loose ends go, what I found interesting as well, we look at Germany as being a Protestant nation, but that was not the way it was. Obviously, before Protestantism hit, if you want to say it was through Luther out of Germany, mm-hmm. everybody was Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And Germany was
Luther was a Catholic priest.
How's that? Been. Yeah.
Luther was a Catholic
right.
priest.
Right. And then again, he gets the rap, or whoever designed the Lutheran symbol to have the Rosicrucis involved. And now what's that about? Now, you've seen that too, right?
Oh, yeah, I have.
I don't know. I mean, I
think it's directly related. Believe me, I'm not trying to knock the Lutherans. I'm, you know, married to a lady who was a Lutheran, but... You know, I've gone to their church services and didn't see anything out of ordinary, you know what I mean? But, yeah, I do believe that all these things have connections at the top within secret meetings and secret societies.
And again, I guess you could say the two most influential countries in Europe. I mean, let's face it. I mean, I'm not trying to... It has been Great Britain and Germany.
Sure.
Now,
no doubt.
France got decimated. I mean, nothing against France, but I mean...
Well, there's really only, really when you get down to the history of the 20th century, there are really only four countries that really are the heavyweights, and that would be the United States, Great Britain, Germany, and Russia.
Oh,
you
mean not Norway?
No.
Oh, damn.
Or Texas either, dang it.
Where are they in Europe? You're right.
We're everywhere.
But the thing is,
we're nationwide.
That's right. You are. You are nationwide. ZZ Top. That's right. Never mind. But you make a good point too. Because again, not going all over the place. But these are the interesting things about history, and that is Russia. I mean, the Tsars had a little problem with the power base in Europe.
Well, look at World War One. I mean, two cousins were fighting it out there to the death. You had the Kaiser and the Tsar. Both of which come from Caesar, but the Kaiser and the Tsar were cousins. They were Queen Victoria's grandsons.
But what's interesting also, and the thing that we'll try to get to if we can throughout this, to me, it's an underlying question. I don't know if that can be answered, but that is, you look at Germany, and it almost seems like it was punished. I understand what I'm saying. It always seems like it was punished twice. Now, you could say, look at the Reich, and could you not understand why that wouldn't be punished? Absolutely. But not necessarily that of pre-World I Germany. But what I'm wondering is, and another thing is, if I'm correct, the Kaisers came from Austria. Three of them. Does that mean?
Can't remember how that works as far as the royal family.
William or Wilhelm, however you want to do that, one and two were the last two.
Yeah.
And I'll brush up on this later, but underneath, I believe William the First. I believe. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Bismarck.
All I know is that, you know, it was basically the royal families, and this is nothing new. The royal families of Europe, especially at that time, were all interrelated.
Yes.
But literally.
Here's where I'm going. Was the unification of Germany, I don't know, something that the Vatican did not want to have happen? I really want to look in that because, again...
Couldn't say. You know, I could just, you know, start running at the mouth about that, but I really couldn't say. I'd have to study it.
No, and again, that's someplace where I'm looking at because it seems to me that Okay, World War II, nobody could really be sympathetic to the Reich. I mean, come on. Mm-hmm. The First World War, it's like, okay, what was Germany doing? They got unified. Maybe that was the problem. I don't know. But a unified Germany, which we have now seen since the wall, quote, got knocked down or whatever, when the Germanys get together or when they're united, they seem to be a very formidable force. I think in this day and age, and probably somewhat earlier in the 20th century, everybody knows what the deal is. Like, you don't get out of line. If you try to, things happen. And that's why I'm wondering why Germany...
I think they were set against each other by what I, for lack of a better term, would call the leaders of the New World Order. And, you know, we know all the suspects there. I think the nations of the world were set against each other as part of the Hegelian dialectic, which they like to play.
Yeah.
And, I mean, they're funding both sides. They're making money off both sides and gaining power. And I think that the plan, which I don't know that it's written down anywhere, but the plan was for three world wars. In fact, Albert Pike is supposedly had said this to Mazzini in his letter to Mazzini. It's a very famous... People say that it never existed. I don't know whether it existed or not. I know that you said you knew a guy who said he had seen it.
William Still,
yeah.
When he did his research, maybe for the Money Masters, I believe that was it, said that he saw it in the London Museum.
Yeah.
And
I think that the whole idea there was to establish fascism and communism, you know, and to have them fight each other, and then another synthesis, and then, you know, eventually they would have three world wars. And the Third World War would establish, once and for all, world government. And I think that's going to result in a Holy Roman Empire in Europe again. And, would be centered in, probably in Germany and Rome. And I know Germany is far and away the most powerful country on the continent of Europe. I mean, they're kicking butt. Economically all over the place, and they're becoming more powerful day by day, and whatever they say goes, and it's just, you know, it's an inevitable consequence.
I would say that, yeah, economically the European Union needs them, but you know, who knows what the bottom line is going to be. And I say that because some people think the European Union is faltering and it's not going to work out and blah blah blah, and that the euro's down. I would admit, it all looks not that solvent right now, but I'm not so sure that it's not going to, you know, get strengthened.
I read an article by a writer who was based in Detroit, and he was saying that, of course, one of the most powerful corporate interests in Germany is the automobile manufacturing community. And he was saying that a strong euro, they're going to prop up the euro. Because a strong euro benefits Germany. So it may very well be. The thing that Germany is sick and tired of, though, is having to, bail out the weaker economies there. I think eventually they're going to have like a two-tier system, and they're going to dominate that system. And the euro basically will be the German mark, you know, I mean, just in a different, slightly different form.
Yeah,
And that's just me talking about economics, and I don't know a whole lot about economics, but I can figure it out that they need a strong euro to keep their economy strong.
The thing is, it goes back to looking at Germany rather than England as some kind of center of whatever power was going on in the last century, for better or for worse. And obviously I think that Britain is very sly and has availed herself of other resources, including the United States, which, of course, got whistled in to fight two world wars on the European continent. It had no business being involved in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everybody says, well, you know, Germany would do this, Germany would do that. Okay, fine. And I've said this time and time again. Why are Americans worried when the Germans didn't cross the channel?
Well, you know, the Germans really never intended to cross the channel. Now, the Japanese may have intended, and I think they did intend, to attack us. They attacked in Alaska. They didn't get very far. But I don't think the Germans ever intended to attack us because they had their own people, you know, members of their elite societies running this country. And in particular, or at least had tremendous influence in this country, in particular it was the Skull and Bone Society at Yale and all the powerful people that came out of that. And I mean, they are, you know, Brown Brothers Harriman and Prescott Bush being the president of the Union Banking Corporation. They sponsored the buildup of the Nazi war machine and the buildup of the Nazi Party and helped the Nazi Party to become what it was. And that was done for the purpose of, as far as I can tell, wanting to have a Second World War. And because they wanted a right-wing dictatorship in Germany that would lead to a Second World War. It was all, you know, part of the plan. I mean, the Harriman family, what's really hilarious about that is it's, you know, you've got this, we've talked many times about the silliness of American politics where people really believe that they have a choice between two competing parties when in effect the parties have the same goal and you don't really have a choice, that they're controlled by a very powerful interest. You've got the Harrimans, who were the godfathers of the Democratic Party. In fact, Pamela Harriman, who is the daughter of Averell Harriman, was the biggest contributor to the Clinton campaign here in recent years, back in 92, and I guess again in 96. But, you know, the Harrimans are like totally identified with the Democratic Party. Well, on the other side, you had Prescott Bush, who mm-hmm. was the president mm-hmm. up there. But, you know, they went to school together at Yale, you know, the Harrimans and the Bushes, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're in the same secret society there, and yet, you know, the big Republicans are fighting the big Democrats, you know.
But in
effect, they just give people the illusion of a choice.
That's right.
I was going to say to you, take a look about how people either wonder or don't wonder at all about the coziness that is shared now by Clinton and the Bushes.
Exactly.
I mean, but this is the way it always has been. And I don't know if people on the outside who listen to, like, stupid mainstream news are saying, well, you see, they patched their fence. No, there was never any holes in their fences to patch. They were connected at the same limb, if you
yeah.
will. And it's no big surprise. One thing I did want to bring up to you, and I tell you what, if we can, we can close here. And,
okay.
And next week, can we start with perhaps one character I think is really interesting that doesn't seem to be remembered all that well in history, and I think it's really Sabatendorf is something else.
Yeah,
and
yeah, Baron, and as I like to call him, Rudy der Fartenpooper.
Be careful.
Okay, that was adolescent stuff. But anyway,
that's why we like it. That's why you come here.
Had to do it.
That's right.
Those German names, boy. Whew.
Yeah, but I mean that guy. I mean,
yeah, and you know he was a 33rd degree Freemason. That's what makes it really funny too.
But also,
and,
didn't
you know,
he have
we're
a...
We're talking about the interrelationship between Germany and the United States. When you get down to it, Germany and the United States have both been heavily influenced and driven by the same secret societies.
Yes. No doubt.
You know?
But wasn't Sabatendorf also involved with Islamic Turkey back...
Yes. Yeah. Sabatendorf spent a great deal of time in Turkey. He was into the Sufism, which is a mystical form of Islam, a secret society within Islam.
And militant.
Yeah, extremely.
Okay. No, I mean, he's a character that
yeah,
really
I'll read you a little something about Sabatendorf here. Sabatendorf, the leader of the Thule Society, was known as an adept at astrology, alchemy, divining rods, and other occult practices.
Well, that's all the
and
basic food
groups.
His
belief that the Jews were really in control of the Freemasonic lodges. Right.
Right.
That probably led to the eventual seizure and closure when the Nazis took power. Indeed, the whole idea of brotherhood that typified Freemasonic beliefs was at odds with what the Thulists believed. Well, I don't know if I buy that. Indeed, Sabatendorf went so far as to say that equality is death. Thus, Freemasons were also singled out by the Nazis. Well, I think Freemasons got, you know, clipped on the chin by the Nazis quite a bit because they were kind of like you say, the fall guy, you know. They were the patsy, you know, in a sense. You know,
we can pick this up, but think about something also. When we were talking about the occult influence
sure.
on the Third Reich, well, what in the world what in the world did Germany have going with Islamic Turkey that they would have the Ottomans on their side in World War One?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it seems to me to be, I don't know, somewhat two disassociated factions, and yet that is not the case whatsoever.
Well, even in World War Two, I mean, it was even more pronounced. The the far right of the Islamic world, which is probably the majority of the Islamic world, was very much behind Hitler. In fact, in Egypt they had a saying, in heaven Allah, and on earth Hitler. You know, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, who was the head cleric in Jerusalem, was a member of the SS, an honorary member of the SS. And in fact, there was a Waffen-SS unit which he was in control of from an administrative point of view. I don't think he fought with them, but there was an Islamic version of the SS.
Yeah. And, you know, I tell you, for another time, I'll just raise people's rankles when I'll say this. Walter Beef has done some work in this area also. He's not the only one. But there is some indication with the Pope and the Vatican, even prior to the Jesuitical takeover in about, what, 1822, that the idea was, okay, you know, Islam can do what you got to do. Just don't touch any Catholics. Mm. That didn't say they couldn't beat up on Protestants and Jews. Mm-hmm. But as long as you leave the Catholics alone, that's fine. And there's a lot of symbolism, if you will, that is somewhat the same between what you see in Vatican City and what's held dear by Islam.
Right.
Yeah, I know that's really inflammatory to say, but I think we can back that up later on. But that's not the focus of what we're doing.
Well, there's something along the same lines, going back to the Thule Society. Svandorf wrote a book called Before Hitler Came, and it was suppressed by the Nazis once Hitler took power because he really didn't want people to be able to trace his footsteps, you know, on his way up. And there's a list of people that belong to the Thule Society, which he wrote up in his book Before Hitler Came. Of course, Baron Rudolf von Sabbatendorf, or Rudy Darn Farton Pooper, was a Grand Master of the Order. He had Guido von List, another occultist, Master of the Order. George Lanz von Liebenfels, also an occultist. Adolf Hitler, of course. Rudolf Hess, Hermann Göring, Heinrich Himmler, Alfred Rosenberg, Hans Frank, Julius Streicher, Karl Haushofer, Gottfried Feder, Dietrich Eckhart, and number 14 that he lists is Bernard Stempel, who was, quote, father, confessor, and confidant of Hitler. Mm-hmm. Well, Bernard Stempel was a Jesuit priest. And he is, many people believe, he is the guy who actually wrote Mein Kampf. They know that he helped edit it. They know that he went to Landsberg Prison, where Hitler was being imprisoned for the Munich beer hall push. And they believe that Father Bernard Stempel was the guy who actually wrote it. In fact, Edmund Paris, who wrote a very good book called The Secret History of the Jesuits, Edmund Paris says that Stempel actually wrote it. Other people say that Stempel probably had a hand in the editing. But isn't it odd that the Thule Society, this occult, totally non-Christian society, should have a member who is a Jesuit priest and called the father, confessor, and confidant of Hitler? I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, it is. But you also cited, who was it that somewhat revered the Jesuit structure?
I believe it was the Rosicrucians.
Okay.
The Rosicrucians in general.
And you had the same thing with Cecil Rhodes.
Yeah.
In building the round table, is that he wanted a structure and also an oath, much like that of the Jesuits. So take that for what it's worth.
Yeah.
Also, I'm just going to end with this, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Just to give a little light on where we might be going.
Yeah.
I did not write this. I'll just say that this was written to me. It said, Bismarck fronted the Second Reich, a Protestant Reich. Are you okay with that?
Yeah.
Or are you neutral, or are you just schools out, or what?
Well, I distinguish Protestant from Christian in the same way that, you know.
Okay.
If you know what I mean?
Are you
it's
saying
like, if you mean Protestant, that you're not Roman Catholic, but you're supposedly Christian, yeah. I would
say
I
agree
true,
with that. Yeah.
Because Prussia was a Protestant, quote, Protestant state, and that's where he was from.
Well,
that was the dominant, you know, the Junkers. He was from the Junker class, which was the aristocrats that ran Prussia. They were very militaristic.
We're talking about Bismarck?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, well, then that would fit. So it said, Wilhelm I had conquered Catholic Austria, 1866, and Catholic France, 1871.
True.
There were assassinations on both Kaiser Wilhelm I and also Bismarck, two attempts on him that failed. It said they had expelled the Jesuit order in 1872 after the order had sought to use France to destroy Protestant Prussia in the Franco-Prussian War of 1870-71.
I think evidence supports that.
Okay. But France lost. Napoleon III then fled to Queen Victoria's Great Britain, and from there the Jesuit order plotted the overthrow of the Protestant Second Reich via the British Crown. Germany being the most powerful and wealthiest nation in Europe, a war was to be incited by the two greatest nations born out of the Protestant Reformation, as its 400-year anniversary was arriving, 1917, and a huge celebration was planned. I don't know. You're okay with that, right?
I believe that's true, and yes, I believe that the Jesuits and the Vatican played all kinds of. I mean, it's historically proven that they played all kinds of games and been involved in many intrigues. And I think what we're talking about here with secret societies, which the Jesuit society is a secret society.
They hide and play sight, and they're perceived as being not a military order, which they are. That's why it's interesting about both the Knights of Malta and also with the Jesuits, because they are considered a military order.
Yeah.
And that is why the lead character is called
the Knights
of Malta.
Even go back to the Crusades, along with the Knights Templar, they were actual knights who fought in the Crusades, the Knights of Malta were.
And so we see this somewhat incestuous warfare that goes on in Europe for whoever wants to finally sit on top of the dung pile.
Yeah.
It seems time and time again, though, that France just winds up being third man out. No affront to them. I mean, it just that's the way it seems. It's like everything was pitched against them as well. And you found this, I guess, much more closer bloodline in some kind of propinquity between Germany and Britain. And
right.
France is kind of like,
right.
No, you're the third one out.
Well, when you get down to it, the Angles and Saxons were Germanic tribes. And of course, English and German, well, I mean, English is a Germanic language. And there's a lot of ties of culture and blood, you know, that the people, and this is really generalizing, but, you know, the Germans and the English are kind of considered cousins.
Yeah. Well, what's also interesting here is that there was always a high pro-German sentiment in this country.
Exactly.
From its founding,
exactly.
Even through World War I and II. And, you know, that's just the way it is. But
it's funny you mention that because my ex-father-in-law, who's deceased now, but he was saying that, and he's pure German. I mean, the community that they grew up in, everybody was German. German-Americans, you know, they had immigrated they had been persecuted in Germany and they had come to the United States or what was then the colonies back in the 1700s. But at any rate, he was saying that during World War I, from what he had heard from, his parents, that a lot of the people within the community he grew up in really supported Germany.
Yeah.
You know, they were not, and they were really upset when the United States went in on the side of Britain and France because they didn't think it should have been done that way.
No, and it should have
been. Of
course,
they were Americans and they supported America, but it was kind of like, well, that's the wrong side to back, you know.
Well, when I just got done with that serial of the Lusitania, I mean, again, I'm not looking to make, I mean, whenever you back Germany, it always sounds like you're a Nazi. That's all we're left with the remnants of. But if you go backwards.
It's unfair. It's really unfair. Like I try to say, though, really there were no good guys in that war. I mean, both sides did terrible things. Both sides committed atrocities. And it was a bad deal all the way around. But Germany is no worse than the British or the French or the United States or the Russians.
But with the Lusitania situation, and really just focusing on that, because that was the spark that got us into World War I.
Right.
And that is the Germans said, look, you know, they gave fair warning to everyone. And, of course, the book documents that Wilson wouldn't let the message get out. Secretary of State William Jennings Bryan was a pacifist and very much eager to get that known, and it was stifled. So the Lusitania sailed, and the president and the prime minister and the king of England all knew what was going to happen. They gave up, this country gave up 1,200 people so that we would finally get into World War One. But I will say this, I mean, the Germans try to say, look, don't do this. We're playing according to the rules. You're bringing over armaments and you're using human shields, basically.
Yeah.
And, you know, that one thing about the German contact that they had over here, who had a German-American newspaper, and he told Brian, William Jennings Bryan, he says, right now, the Lusitania is being loaded with munitions on Pier 54 in the Hudson. Okay?
Yeah.
Bang. I'm sorry not to use that word, but, you know, that's what happened. And there, the rest is history. So,
well, it was a terrible event, and the sad part is, much like 9/11 and other events of that type, a false flag attack like that, the people that get hurt are innocent people.
They're always
sacrificed. I'm sure that you know that most of the people on the Lusitania had no idea that somebody was carrying war munitions. You know?
Yeah. No, I mean
they were just trying to go to go on a trip. Probably a lot of them on vacation. You know. And kind of like somebody getting on a plane to go to Europe now, but they were on a luxury liner. Hey, you know, we're going to Britain, you know.
In the modern day.
It's horrible, man.
But here's my point. Don't give me this stuff about Christian government. Don't give me this stuff.
No.
You can't have a Christian government until the Lord returns again. Everything else that we have here is not even a facsimile of. It's just human government that fails time and time again. And in the history of the United States, so they spin it differently, as you well know, Larry. I mean, we got some sailors sacrificed in the Maine incident to spark the Spanish-American War. Then we do it again with the Lusitania. Then we do it again with Pearl. And you can insert others in there also before we get into 9/11. That's the Murrow bombing in Oklahoma City.
Right.
You know, and the first bombing, well, the first attempt at bringing the towers down, I believe that was in February 94. Or 93, whatever it was.
Yeah, I believe it was 94.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, time and time again, it's setting an incident up to obviously garner resentment toward an external force, not internal, and it works every time. And it's going to happen again.
A classic example was the Nazis and the Reichstag fire. And they used the term terrorism. That's where, I mean, when you start looking at what happened with 9/11, you can see it's just taken out of the old Nazi playbook. It's just like a coach, you know, putting together a successful play. That's what it was. The Reichstag fire and 9/11. I mean, there's so many parallels. Okay, the Reichstag fire was a false flag event. The Nazis did it themselves, burned down the Reichstag and blamed it on the communists and started yelling and screaming about terrorism and the communists did it. And, I mean, all these signs pointed back to the Nazis themselves, but they successfully, were able to convince the German people that it was the communists. So they went around, rounded up all the communists, and they went ahead and got the socialists and the liberals and everybody else on the left, rounded them up, put them in the can, and then they enacted something very similar to the Patriot Act, which was called the Enabling Act, which essentially just shut down all of, the civil rights of the German people, you know, the right to freedom of speech, freedom of press, et cetera, freedom of communication, et cetera, and just basically established the police state. And here in America, I mean, that's really the same thing that was done with the Patriot Act. If you read that thing, I mean, it sets up a police state.
Also,
and the difference here is that in America, we do it our own way. We do it very slowly.
Yeah, but, you know...
And everybody in America, you know, we've always been trained to think, it can't happen here. We're Americans. Don't you understand? We're Americans. It cannot happen here.
And people should look up the Internal Security Act or the McCarran Act, because that came after World War II. Yeah. I would even agree that it was more draconian than the Patriot Act, because it was more general and vague, and, of course, you can make that do anything you want to. So we have a history, especially in post-World War II, in lieu of having any really big bad enemies in world wars. We have other stuff that happens. Yeah, we had Korea, we understand that. We had Vietnam, we understand that. But there's always something going on in post-World War II that brings us closer and closer to obviously more ubiquitous state rule. And we see that now in transportation, all to keep us safe. And it's the same old scam run time and time again. And it's not over yet. So, All right, listen, Larry, if we can, we'll pick up with some of the other principles in this whole general
scenario.
Yeah, I'd
like to talk about Sabatendorf and the Thule Society and the Brill Society and the Black Sun. And going from there, and also then we could begin to talk about the Skull and Bone Society and how all these secret societies were involved and they were not all in Germany. That's something Americans just don't get, is that so much of what happened with the Third Reich came from the good old U.S. of A. And not from the common, ordinary citizen, but from people who are very rich and powerful people within secret societies.
Yeah, the elite, no doubt about
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
I mean, they are just not your average Americans. All right. Listen, thanks for coming on
sure.
and spending the time that you did. And we'll hit round two pretty soon.
Sorry for the adolescent humor, but I just had to throw it in there.
Look, you know who you're talking to, don't you? You want me to do warm pit farts? I can do that, you know.
I love it. Rudy Dufartin poop. But anyway.
Yeah, well, I also had to play the outro song, which you picked also.
Oh, yeah.
So don't get done apologizing yet.
Oh, not really. It was a false apology. I've just had fun doing it.
Well, at least you admitted it. Okay.
I just wanted, you know, for those out in the audience who are more sophisticated than us, it might not have gone over very well, but I'm sorry.
Well, they're all more sophisticated than us. That's why we do this.
That's probably true.
Oh, damn. Yeah. It doesn't make them right, though. Anyway.
No, it doesn't.
I'll see you next week.
All right. Take it easy, Biz.
When the Führer says, "Wie ist der Meister Ace?" "Wie heil, heil!" Right in the Führer's face, not to love the Führer is a great disgrace. So wie heil, heil! Right in the Führer's face. When Herr Goebbels says, "Wie own the world in space?" "Wie heil, heil!" Right in Herr Goebbels' face. When Herr Göring says, "They'll never bomb this place." "Wie heil, heil!" Right in Herr Göring's face. Are we not the Superman? Aryan pure Superman.
Yeah, we are the Superman.
Super duper Superman.
Is this Nazi land so good? Would you leave it if you could?
Yeah, this Nazi land is good. We would leave it if we could.
We bring the world new order. Heil Hitler's world new order.
Everyone of foreign race will love the Führer's face when we bring to the world disorder.
When the Führer says, "He is the master race," we heil, heil! Right in the Führer's face, not to love the Führer is a great disgrace. So we heil, heil! Right in the Führer's face.
Right in the Führer.